Hi, everyone. It's been just over 2 years since I was sexually assaulted at Harvard, and it's been a little under a year since my experience with the disciplinary process came to an end. I've had some time to reflect, and I decided that if I were to ever share my story, I'd share it from the personal side, not the policy side. I would want to share what it's like when your dad answers the phone and you have to find a way to tell him that the one thing he never wanted to happen to his little girl had happened. Or what it's like sitting in a room of Harvard professors as they look at a magnified photo of your backside covered in bruises and broken blood vessels. Because those are the personal moments that no one ever talks about. But alas, here I am at the center of U.S. policy. And it's here that I've realized that with an issue like sexual assault, the personal and the political are inseparable. In my 8-month experience with Harvard's policies, I interacted with a lot of people. Some were the definite good guys, those people at Harvard's Office of Sexual Assault Prevention and Response, and those at Boston's Victim Rights Law Center. Then there were the definite bad guys, my attacker and the faculty that gamed the system in order to support him. But then there were a lot of people who fell somewhere in between. These are the people, most of them administrators, who, despite having the best intentions, were paralyzed by the institution's archaic and misinformed policies. It's for those people, the ones in between, and the thousands and thousands of students with stories like mine, for whom the hard work of this task force will be the most meaningful. So, I'm honored to introduce someone who's played an instrumental role in this work and someone who is undoubtedly one of the good guys, Mr. Vice President.
Mom, you did an incredible job. An incredible job. Madeline, a lot of us in here, particularly a lot of the women in here, know what an incredible amount of courage it took for you to stand up and say that and say what you've been saying. But there's a lot of good guys in this room. I want to introduce you to a couple good guys who are sitting behind you, I see right here, who I've worked with for a long time. Now, none of them are old enough to have worked when I passed the Violence Against Women Act, but they've taken it further. I'd like to, if you turn around, you can see Claire McCaskill, Senator McCaskill from the state of Missouri. She's one of the good guys. And Kristen Gillibrand, who's one of the really good guys as well. And a guy who not only as senator but as former attorney general took up this cause with a passion, Senator Blumenthal from the state of Connecticut. And I'm prejudiced, one of the really, really good guys is, I call him Bobby. He doesn't like being called that, but that's why we knew him in Scranton. Bobby Casey. And the neighborhood Bobby and I were raised in, and I want you all to listen to this. If a man raised his hand to a woman, you had a job to kick the living crap out of him if he did it. It was a simple proposition. Excuse my language. But that's the neighborhood we come from. That's the neighborhood we come from. Now, I realize that's not very presidential or vice presidential, but it's something every man should begin to understand. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Every parent prays for one thing. I know I did when I dropped my daughter off at college far away in that first day, and I looked around, and every father and mother does. You pray, you say a little extra prayer, except especially if you know the statistics. You say a little prayer that the one thing that we hope is my daughter will be safe, that my daughter will be safe, that she'll have an experience at this university where she can learn, she can grow, and she can flourish, where she can gain confidence, where she can become the person you know she's capable of becoming. But, you know, we all know that many of our schools just aren't safe. We know the numbers. 1 in 5 of every one of those young women who's dropped off that first day of school, before they finish school, will be assaulted in her college years. But these just aren't numbers. These are our friends. These are our daughters. These are our neighbors. These are your classmates. They're the ones who, and some of them are you. Some of them in this audience are you. And, you know, there's an awful lot of them who, these young women who still have trouble sleeping at night, staring at the ceiling, dealing with a system that, both in the civil courts, criminal courts, as well as in the colleges, who assault them again. It's not the only assault is what they occur at the hands of that man or that boy. They get assaulted again. And so many young women blame themselves. You know, back when I started this, I say I didn't do all, I mean I, but when I drafted the Violence Against Women Act, nobody wanted to do much about this. As a matter of fact, I couldn't get any of the national groups to support it initially. I say this all the time, but I want to give incredible credit to Elie Schmiel, the first one of all the women's groups to finally say, okay, we'll get engaged. Up to that time, no one would endorse it. The fact of the matter is that what we learned a long time ago is the ugly little secret that about rape and sexual assault. And that is the attacker is usually not a stranger. It's someone that you know. Creating overwhelming complaints. We had held over 1,000 hours of hearings. We had psychiatrists and psychologists testify. They pointed out the most difficult assault to recover from is the one where you knew the victim. Reams and reams and reams of testimony and evidence of why didn't I know? What did I do? Was it my fault? What was I wearing? What did I say? I'll never forget there was a young woman who was one of the first people to testify. And her name was Christine. And she, by the time she testified before my committee, she had gone public and set up an organization to deal with survivors, help survivors. And she went to a small college in southeastern Pennsylvania. And during the orientation period, her freshman year, there was a big bonfire on the night, Friday night, a pep rally before a game on Saturday. It happened to be a soccer game, not a football game, but a big pep rally. And she was standing there with one of her girlfriend's boyfriends. Nice guy. And when it was all over, she said, I'm going back to my dorm. He said, I'll walk you back to your dorm. And he said, but on the way, can we stop? I want to pick up my jacket. And she walked into his dorm, and he pulled her into the room, and he raped her. She went back to her dorm, and I'll never forget her testimony. She said, the first thing I did was take my clothes off and take a scalding shower. My room was on the fourth floor. Said, I wrapped a towel around me and went back and was sitting on the edge of my bed crying when the RA came in, the resident advisor. And she said, what happened? And she said, I told her. And she looked at me and she said, you've been raped. And I looked back at her and I said, No, I knew him. No, I knew him. Maybe one of the single most difficult things we, all of you who have been involved in this fight and cause for so long, have had to do was try to fight against the notion that it was ever, 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 under any circumstance, the woman's fault. No man has a right, under any circumstance, other than self-defense, no man has a right ever to raise his hand to a woman. Period. End of story. It is assault if they do. And to get that through to our daughters and our sisters and our friends is still such a culturally difficult thing to do. You know, another thing we learned is that all too often we ask, almost always, ask the wrong questions when it comes to rape and sexual assault. We, meaning the authorities, whether they're at, as Madeline referenced, at a university, an administrator asking a question, or anyone else, or police forces, which have gotten better, or any circumstance. We ask the wrong question. We continue to ask questions like, well, what were you wearing? What did you say? What did you do? The real question is, what made him think that he had a right to do what he did? You know, Claire, when I started this, we did a survey of every single state law, every single state and the laws on this issue. In my own state of Delaware, you could not be convicted of first-degree rape if, in fact, you knew the man. The assumption being, if you knew him and you went out with him, it must have been something that you did. And that still prevails in an awful lot of places. The law's changed. I can't say it often enough. It doesn't matter what, quote, she was wearing, whether she drank too much, whether it was in the back of a car, in her room, on the street. It does not matter. It does not matter if she initially said yes and then changed her mind and said no. No means no, whenever it is stated. And if you're incapable because of your physical state to say anything, it is no. It requires a verbal consent. Everything else is rape or assault. Everything else. And until we as a society acknowledge that, and men begin to step up to their responsibility, this will not be solved. And the same goes for young boys and young men who are victims, because they are. In lesser number, but they are victims as well. We have to do everything in our power to protect them. These are our children. These are our wives, our daughters, our sisters. These people are you. I'm really proud that now you all have a report with very clear recommendations. I want to thank Valerie and Tina for once the president gave me the permission to hire the woman who you first saw standing here, who's done an incredible job, they have taken up the passion of my life and I think of theirs. I can't tell you how much I personally appreciate the passion with which you have taken on this cause. And so the first report, not alone, the first report of the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault, you know, I want to give you a very quick shout out. to the people who put this together. The presidential innovation fellows and a dedicated team of the General Service Administration, by the way, did a great job. They also have a website that you can go to, which is really, quite frankly, incredible. By the way, is Congresswoman Spear here? I didn't recognize you. I apologize. Speaking of one of the good guys, I truly apologize. But I also want to thank the Deputy Attorney General Cole, and I want to thank Arnie Duncan, who feels this in his bones, and I want to thank Kathleen Sebelius for explaining how we're going straight to the heart of the matter with the recommendations we're announcing today. Folks, look, I understand all the excuses, and I understand all the rationale, and some of it on the surface seems appropriate, but colleges and universities can no longer turn a blind eye or pretend rape and sexual assault doesn't occur on their campus. I understand. I understand that the good guys in the report, they feel like they may be damaging the reputation of their schools. I get it, but it doesn't matter. We need to provide survivors with more support, and we need to bring perpetrators to justice. And we need the college and university to step up and learn the lessons which we have learned in the implementation of the Violence Against Women Act on the criminal side. And we have some very specific things that we recommend, and a few points that I'll just end with that I think are important to make here. Colleges and universities need to face the fact that what exists on their campuses, they need to step up to it. And one way to do that is through an anonymous survey that gives a true measure of sexual assault climate on their campuses, so you can no longer rationalize. Only 13% of college rape victims report crime to campus police or local law enforcement. They don't report for a number of reasons. They fear that they'll be shamed, they're embarrassed, they are scared that they won't be able to be safe on campus with their attacker roaming around or maybe sitting in the same history class next to her because of their attacker's friends. They worry that they will be on the humiliating end or on the physical end of more abuse, and that life will be made more miserable for them. They worry that the school will ask invasive questions, as were asked, questions the school has absolutely no right to ask. No right to ask. You can't ask some of the questions the school asks in a criminal proceeding. You're not even allowed to ask some of the questions. They have no right to know about your sexual history or your conduct. It's none of their business. It is irrelevant. We've made it that way in the court system, and it should be that way in the public system. Look, we've learned a lot about by implementing the Violence Against Women Act. We know that no woman should be subject to humiliation. It's unacceptable. You know, there's only a brief period of time when a woman comes forward, and if she's not greeted with open arms and embraced, she will, in fact, walk away because it's a hard thing to do. You know, and I speak to audiences over the years, particularly I'd go to men's audiences, and they'd say, why doesn't she just say something? And I'd point out, you know, when you were a kid, you were the bully in the schoolyard and took your lunch money and had you down. What'd your father or mother tell you? Tell him what my mother told you. Just smack him in the nose. How many of you tough guys had the nerve to smack him in the nose? How many of you did? And if, God forbid, you walked out and somebody patted you in the rear end, your boss, or said something to you, how many of you would go report it? And the line I always use is, how many of you men in here saw the movie Deliverance? I know what scene you remembered, right? How many of you would walk out of the woods and report, I've been raped? Most men say, I'd go home and get my gun and I'd come back and I'd take care of it. Give me a break. Look, by the way, that's one of the things we're trying to fix here. Arnie Duncan is going to fix it. His guidance in telling schools they can't ask the sorts of questions about victim sexual history. It is off limits. I challenge every college and university, if they are really serious about protecting students, to conduct anonymous surveys. They have a moral responsibility to know what's happening on their campus. Another point the report makes clear is that every abused woman or man needs a safe and confidential place to report rape and sexual assault. The evidence shows that one of the most important things in dealing with rape or sexual assault is being able to talk to someone so they can seek help rather than blame and stay in silence. Recently, some schools have told nearly all their employees, including some offering confidential services like rape crisis centers and women's centers, that they had to report all the details of the rape assault to the school. That's the exact opposite thing they should be doing. All that means is the victim is quickly losing control over her life and what happens next. We've got a proposal to fix that. We're telling schools that they need to let these counselors and advocates keep the survivor's personal information private and only report the incident as it happens to the school, that an incident happened, and keep an eye on to make sure these incidents don't happen again. And the last point I want to make is that we're never going to solve this epidemic until we get men involved. They have to be part of the solution. That's what the new public service announcement that the president and I are releasing today is all about. It sends a powerful message, a message to guys. Rape is rape. Don't look away. Do something. Speak up. Stand up. So I'd like you to take a look at that PSA before I conclude. Are we going to show that now? Do we have it? There you go.
We have a big problem, and we need your help.
It's happening on college campuses, at bars, at parties, even in high schools.
It's happening to our sisters and our daughters.
Our wives and our friends.
It's called sexual assault, and it has to stop.
We have to stop it. So listen up.
If she doesn't consent, or if she can't consent, it's rape, it's assault.
It's a crime. It's wrong.
If I saw it happening, I was taught you have to do something about it.
If I saw it happening, I speak up.
If I saw it happening, I'd never blame her. I'd help her.
Because I don't want to be a part of the problem.
I want to be a part of the solution.
We need all of you to be part of the solution. This is about respect. It's about responsibility.
It's up to all of us to put an end to sexual assault. And that starts with you.
Because one is too many.
By the way, you know, I'm not used to picking up the phone and calling big old movie stars, you know. But I called them. Every one of them said immediately, every single one of them said immediately, what do you want me to do? What can I do? This is about letting young men, boys and men, know what it means to be a man. It's cowardly. It's simply cowardly to raise your hand to a woman or to a child or to someone smaller than you, a man who's defenseless. We need to send a message to men everywhere. You've got to be part of the solution. We need to send a message to victims everywhere. We're here for you. It's not your fault. You're not alone. And we shouldn't rest. We can't rest. This is the measure of who we are as a society. Everyone has a responsibility to act, from college presidents to college students, because every woman and man has a God-given right to be free from sexual violence. I'll end by saying it again. I was raised by a gentle man, a strong man. And he used to say, and I'm not joking, from the time we were kids, Bobby knew my dad. He'd say, the greatest offense, the cardinal sin, is the abuse of power, whether it's abuse of economic power or physical power. He used to say, the single most abusive way to abuse power is for a man to raise his hand to a woman. And if you see it, you've got to speak up. You've got to act. You've got to have the nerve to jump in. My mom said it a slightly different way. Say you're defined by your courage and you're redeemed by your loyalty. That's what men have to start to do more than they do now. So, ladies and gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for feeling about this as I do. I can't thank my colleagues from the Congress for their continued push in the legislative side of this. And, kiddo, and by the way, she's as old as my daughter. We're friends back there, so I'm not being disrespectful. I got permission. I'll end where I began. You, I think, probably significantly underestimate how much courage you give to so many young women who've been through what you've been through. So many young women who are still having nightmares. So many, to see the kind of courage it took for you to stand up before the whole nation and say what you did. You're an incredible young woman. You're an incredible lady. Thank you for your strength, and thank you all. We got to stick with this till it's done, folks. Thank you.